everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two things are one and the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genre. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And Author Magazine is funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their yearly writers' conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, it has been my experience that writers usually know they are going to write at a very young age. The average age in my unofficial, unscientific survey is about 9. Now, Margaret George, my guest today, I don't remember actually what age she knew she was interested in writing, but she knew from a very early age, a very precocious age, that she was interested in history. I hope she'll share that story with us today. And that interest in history eventually manifested itself in some of the best historical novels out there today. And in my experience, there's nothing, no one better to talk to than someone leading the life they are meant to lead, which is why I am so glad to have Margaret on the show today with me to talk to me. So let's get her on here. Margaret, welcome to Author.
Thank you. I'm so delighted to be here. There.
Here, there, and everywhere. Now you're on the internet. You're worldwide.
Right. I'm everywhere.
Well, it's great to have you on, Margaret. I want to begin by letting folks know that Elizabeth, your last novel, is just out in paperback, trade paperback. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. It has a nice new cover on it, and it's done very well. It's been very well received. It's come out for the first time in England about the same time. So Elizabeth is getting kind of a rebirth this spring.
Now, what do the English think of this Yankee handling their famous Virgin Mother? What do they think of that? Queen Mother.
Well, you know, I started with Henry VIII when I did the autobiography of Henry VIII, and the English seemed very pleased with it, and I figured out later that because of my name, they probably thought I was British, and they didn't realize I was an American.
Right.
So I think that's part of it. It helps to have a British-sounding name. It is my real name, by the way. Anyway, I think that they're somewhat forgiving. We don't correct the American spelling anymore, which is what they did before. They used to take the books and change favor, add
the essence and civilization into.
Yeah, but they don't do that anymore.
Oh, they think it's more exotic having the American spellings.
I don't know, or maybe my cover's just been blown so they don't bother.
You know, I have to say, this book, we mentioned this briefly in our conversation. If you haven't seen it, folks, there's a great video interview we did with Elizabeth probably a year ago now when they released the hardback I called you Elizabeth.
Yeah, it's because of the book.
Margaret.
Yeah, that's right.
I call you Elizabeth. We did with Margaret back when she released Elizabeth a year ago. And I told her then that really I learned that everybody reads things for different reasons, and there's particular reasons I think lovers of historical fiction read historical fiction. And I finally, because I wasn't normally a connoisseur of historical fiction, but I got it when I read Elizabeth, especially when old Shakespeare stepped onto the stage. I got it. I was like, oh, I so want to see what Shakespeare does. Even though I know she wasn't there taking notes, I want to see how she brings him to life. And I thoroughly got it and enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. No, that was part of the fun of historical novels, is that you get to spend time with these people that are these icons, and you get to have conversations with them, and you get to kind of fill in the gaps of their lives. Because Shakespeare, there's so much we don't know about it, which means that you're free to invent things about him as long as it doesn't contradict something that either is common sense or that we really would be out of character.
Yeah,
but I enjoyed that part immensely.
I think that the historical novelist has got every kind of writer has got their own challenges, and of course yours are that you've got to to because you've got to love history, A. So obviously you love to delve into what actually happened to the best of your ability to learn that. So on the one hand, you've got to be very realistic in this one way. And so there's that job. You've got to provide the reader with a rich sense of what it would have been to be alive and been in Elizabeth's court, for instance. So that's the one job. But then the other job is you're a writer, you're a storyteller, and you're an entertainer. And I would think that that is the balance that is the artistry of the historical novelist.
Well, I think you've described it perfectly. I've been on some panels at literary festivals recently, and it's been a topic, the fact and fiction.
Yeah.
And how much do you let the facts dictate how you tell the story? And, of course, historical fiction is a big tent. I mean, it goes all the way from the people that would never, ever, ever change a fact or
right.
ever invent a conversation to the people that really don't. It just seems to act as wallpaper in
right.
the background, but they're not very particular about it being accurate or not. And I think, yeah, but if it's not readable, you really, the whole point is gone. I think it's easy for historical novelists to become very self-important about their knowledge of history and
right.
forget that if it's not readable, it's not going to be accessible, and they've failed in their major task, which is to create a novel. Because people sometimes will ask, you know, why do you write fiction and not nonfiction? And I think that the difference is, of course, that one has to be just got to have a forward momentum and have some engagement directly with the emotions of the reader.
Yes, yes. You've hit it right on the head, Margaret, because even those people who think they just want to learn what happened, human beings are, I believe, first and foremost, emotional creatures. I don't care if you're a scientist or an athlete. I don't care who you are. You're an emotional creature. And while we might have wanted to know, like, if I'm going to read about Elizabeth Court, yes, I want to know what it looked like and smelled like, but I want to know what it felt like. What did it feel like to be back then? And what did she go through emotionally as a human being, not just this, you know, historical monument called Elizabeth? What did it feel like? You know?
Yes, that's right. And if you can't portray that, then it belongs in the nonfiction. I mean, there are some, not that nonfiction is dull at all, but it just has a different purpose. It doesn't necessarily try to arouse emotion or identification in the reader.
No.
But many years ago, I was growing up, I think historical fiction was more considered mainstream. I mean, it wasn't considered its own genre the way it
right.
is now. It certainly was reviewed along with regular books and considered like regular books. And maybe it's the proliferation of so many books now that...
Well, it's the genrefication of fiction, period. You know, everything has been busted up into... And I see it happening now in young adult fiction. First, it was just
really?
Young adult fiction. Oh, yeah, now it's young adult romance, young adult fantasy. So they're breaking into all this young adult literary. It's not as defined yet. They don't have their own sections in the bookstore, but they are starting to have their own bookshelves in the bookstore. So, yes, it's starting to happen to young adult, too, which is so popular right now.
Yeah, I don't know why, whether it's the number of books or that we just have a desire as a species to subdivide everything. But, I remember when historical novels like Exodus wouldn't be stuck in a special shelf.
No,
it was,
no.
Or the Mishner or Gore Vidal's Julian and his Lincoln. And
right.
Mary Renault was just a mainstream book. She wasn't a, quote, historical novelist.
Right.
I don't know.
That's
I don't
the way
know.
It's gone, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you said something to me during our interview, which was that, you were talking about this balance between history and facts and what happened and telling a story, and that you said that the one crime you said you felt, the first crime the writer must not commit is to be boring. Do you remember saying that
yes,
to me?
I do remember that. I had heard that someone said the most heinous crime a writer can commit is
right.
to be boring. So I always figure that I keep that little mantra going in my mind when I'm worried about something seeming too over the top or too emotional or something. I think, well, it's better that than to be boring.
Right. Well, it's so true. You know, I was thinking about my first history class I ever took, practically the only history, now probably actually now that I think about it, the only history class I took in college, which was Western Civilization, freshman year, two semesters, you know, from like Old Testament up to the Eisenhower years, especially, right?
Well,
and the first semester, what's that?
That's a nice short subject.
Yeah, isn't it? So they were just ripping through it. But the first half, the first semester was taught by these two professors. They were just great. One guy was this tall Midwestern Protestant who let us know he was the only member of the history department that believed Jesus was resurrected, and then his partner was this short, rotund, atheist Jewish guy, and they went at it. It was like theater. You know, they were debating whether it was the Dark Ages, and it was great. It was like this fantastic story that these two really entertaining guys were telling, and I soaked it up. You know, I just loved it. And then the second semester, they brought in this guy who was a specialist, you see, who had been to Russia. This is 1984, and he'd been to Russia. That was a big deal, you know. And he was going to come in and teach us about the 20th century because he was the European specialist. And so he had World War I and World War II, particularly World War II. That was his specialty. And listening to this guy talk about World War II was like listening to someone read the phone book. It was the most boring experience of my life. I was like falling asleep in class, and I thought, this is World War II, for God's sakes. He's got Stalin and Hitler and Hiroshima, and he killed it. And I thought of you, and you talking about the crime of boring. I thought, here was a man with a subject that really seemed almost impossible to screw up, but he did. I mean, he just did it so flat. It was just this thing happened, and that thing happened, and this thing happened, and that thing, and I just about died.
Oh. Well, see, poor history has that reputation. You know, that history and math, where people go, oh, it's so boring. But
right.
It shouldn't be boring, because history itself is not boring. I just think we've had a lot of people like that professor,
yeah.
Unfortunately, that has turned people off. And so I think the job of historical novelists is to reclaim some of that, reclaim some of the interest in history and make history fun again for people.
Yeah.
And because there are books in every era, I mean, if you ever look at those historical novel reviews, there's actually one put out by the Historical Novel Society. And, you know, you look up your century, it's like they'll say prehistoric, and then there's ancient Greece, ancient
right.
Rome, Dark Ages, 11th century, and there are tons of books in each of these categories. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just... So I think there's sort of something for everyone.
You know, it seems to me, now I just finished writing a book that was a kind of memoir, so it was my own history, but even with that, where I have a lot of information, I understood that in telling it, I had to choose a lens that would serve as a kind of filter for all the details I would choose to provide, because even in the short span of time that I was covering in this book, which was like 8 years, I couldn't give it all, obviously. And I had to choose the sort of message of the book and what I wanted to deliver. And so I had to filter those details I would choose to share. And it seems to me that the historical novelist for sure has to do that. You can't give it all. And so to some degree, it's unavoidable that you are putting, I don't want to say a bias, but a perspective. You're granting a perspective by the story you choose to tell, by what you choose to select to focus on. And do you do that ahead of time, or do you delve into the material and let the focus come to you, or do you not think about that at all?
Oh, I have to think about it, because the first thing you have to choose is point of view. I mean, who is telling the story?
Right.
Because if you get the wrong point of view, the wrong person telling the story, the whole, it's a different story, like you said. It's going to be a different story depending on who's telling it. So I have to think about what story do I want to tell, and it is greatly tempting to try to include everything, I do have to say.
Oh, is that right?
You'd never guess from my books, would you, the size of them.
There's a lot of stuff in there. And in fact,
Elizabeth is a very good example of that, in the sense that I decided I did not want to do her whole life.
Right.
I had done the other people's whole lives, but I decided with Elizabeth, I wanted to focus on the last years of her reign, which from the Armada on, which is the last 15 years, for several reasons. One of them was that a lot of people don't do that. They kind of stop the story with the Armada. And the second is because, you know, that I felt that the last part of her reign, when she's aging and trying to hang on to power and dealing with a lot of, you know, losses and challenges, because the three biggest challenges of her reign actually came in the end of it. And she was queen for over 40 years, but the biggies, which is Mary Queen of Scots and what to do with her, the attack of the Armada, and then the rebellion of the Earl of Essex, which was really the last time that an English subject tried to overthrow the king or queen, although they didn't know that then. But you know, so her big crises all came in those years. And so, plus the most interesting characters like Shakespeare. So I had to choose, you know, to focus, to start with 1588 instead of 1533. And, you know, people complained. They said, well, but you've left out the first part of her life. And then it would be a different book. I mean, it's almost like they couldn't accept that I'm telling this particular part of her life, which is a story in itself. But I think it was a better book for that, and it allowed me to concentrate on the things I wanted to show. Because, you know, as we live, our focus and what's important to us changes. We live a lot of lives in one life.
We do.
And, you know, what you cared about as a teenager, there'd be a different book than what you care about now.
That's right. It's a good point. You know, as you talk about it, talk about people complaining, first of all, to all my writing listeners out there who are trying to get their first book published, no matter what you publish and no matter how well it does, and Margaret's books do very well and they're very well reviewed, someone is going to complain about them. Someone will always have a complaint. And as I listen to you talk about it, it occurs to me that fans of history remind me a little bit of fans of, like, Lord of the Rings and Star Wars or something, and that they always got some complaint about some way some detail was handled, that it wasn't absolutely to the whatever. Do you find that to be the case with history fans, or am I just projecting?
Oh, yes. Some of them are very, very particular, and they don't what they're really saying is, you didn't write it the way I would have written it.
Right. Are you kind to them?
I try to be of him, but, you know, I think that I don't like to disappoint people, but on the other hand, getting into what you'd said about your book is your life, I don't want to not write the book that I feel I want to write to please somebody else, so I'm sorry that I didn't, that it isn't what they wanted, but, you know, there'll be a lot of other books about Elizabeth, and maybe those will be the ones they wanted.
Well,
it's not the only book ever written about Elizabeth, so.
Yeah, I really feel that you have to write the book that you want to write, because you have to write the book that you know on some level that it's hard to describe has a value, that is valuable, that if you were to see it, you'd want to read it, and you can feel within yourself its value, why that is of use to someone else. And if you tried to write someone else's book, you wouldn't really know, other than the fact that they wanted it, why it was valuable. I think you have to know for yourself why it is worth sharing with someone else. And the only way to do that is to write the book that you would want to read, your version that you want to see.
You know, something calls out to you about it. Something appeals to you about it. You know, one thing about history people is that something that's been happening recently is that authors have been that write these historical novels have been starting to take readers, passionate readers, that is, people very involved in the story, to trips to places that are covered in their books, but they're actually history books, like, I mean, historical sites, like you go to the place where Henry VIII is buried and so on, or especially things that there are scenes in your books about it. And Sharon K. Penman did this with Eleanor of Aquitaine, and I'm going to be doing it in the fall with Henry VIII and Elizabeth. Luckily, a lot of their sites are the same.
So you're going to do this. You're going to be leading a tour.
And I will be leading this tour, and people can find out about it by going to my website. But I will be, like, you know, there'll be certain scenes in the book, like, that took place here, but then we're also going to have a guide that's a historian that can talk about other aspects of the site as well.
Right.
That way I'm not responsible for knowing everything about the Tower of London, only what happened to Henry in the Tower of London, or Anne Boleyn. So that's something that, you know, I'm wondering about. Are you going to get passionate history people that you know, that, well, Sharon said some of them that are so passionate they want to talk about it morning, noon, and night, and you can't even eat breakfast because
you
must
get that.
Must be answering these questions all the time. So.
That's right.
But it's But it's nice that people are passionate about history. I mean, we shouldn't complain. It's a nice thing to know that people care and are interested in it.
Now so Elizabeth was published hardback last year. The paperback's out now, and so you must be hard at work on another project.
I'm starting another large project, which is sort of called out to me in that it originally was going to be about Nero. I mean, it's just going to be another one of my books about Nero, but now I'm thinking of it should be really about the Roman Empire, and it should have Boudica, the queen in Britain who almost kicked the Romans out, and then St. Paul, who went to Rome and was beheaded, actually, and martyred in St. Peter under Nero. It was those 10 years were really quite something, and I thought there's three aspects of the Roman Empire. There's the emperor, and then there's the area that they've been in the Roman Empire long enough that they're kind of used to being part of it, not that
right.
they love being part of it, but Paul was a Roman citizen, which is why he could appeal to the emperor. And then there's the newly conquered empire parts that don't want to be in it
right.
and, want to rebel and want to get free. And I thought, I think the subject actually, rather than Nero himself exactly, would be, the whole psychology of the Roman Empire. I mean, now this is kind of a modest project, right? I have to find a way to tell it that will be succinct and maybe be creative in getting, from one part of the material to the other. And above all, should be readable and entertaining.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say it might actually be more entertaining because of all the three different characters that it would focus on.
I would think that would help bounce it along, actually. The few historical novels I've read, I've liked when they've been able to move from character to character. It helps for the sweep, of history. But, it reminds
mm-hmm.
me, as you mentioned Rome, I interviewed Alice Hoffman, the novelist, sort of just mainstream novelist,
huh?
I guess you could say, a year ago. And she was working, the book's out now, a book that took place in ancient Rome. And she said it was very hard. She's written about, everything from very contemporary to moving back in time.
Uh-huh.
But she said it was very hard to write about because, as just a straight novelist, she's not really a historical novelist, but a straight novelist, she needed all the details about everyday life because she wasn't writing about historical figures. She was writing about ordinary people in Rome. And she said it was very hard, and I'm curious how you might have overcome this, to find those details of, what was it like when you woke up in a house in Rome? What was around you? What did you do? What did you smell? What did you see? Because that's the stuff, you've got to have those kinds of details. Have you had, obviously there's the big events, but have you had trouble finding the sort of detail events to bring the thing fully to life?
Well, not so much because, we have Pompeii. Thank goodness we have Pompeii.
Oh, right.
That's because they've excavated so much, and there you actually see the kind of things, the chairs they sat on and the kind of beds they
have
laid
you been
on.
There?
I've been to Pompeii, and I've been to several exhibits that have traveled around with the articles from Pompeii. You've got all these details. They even have the bread got carbonized that they were eating.
Wow.
And you can see what a loaf of bread looked like. I think that's probably the best source of that. And then Herculaneum, its neighbor, got buried under mud. And the
right.
thing about the mud is that preserves the wood and preserves some things that they didn't in Pompeii. So we do have a wealth of those things, thank goodness. So I don't think, at least, see, that's the era of that I'm writing about. Now, if you were doing it later or earlier, you wouldn't have those things.
Right. And you said to me when I talked to you about research that you don't, I assume you have an assistant, but you really want to handle the research because you don't know always what it is you're going to need, that your research is kind of you cast a wide net and get and kind of round up all you can and put them on these index cards because the research might guide you in the writing and you don't want to lose some detail that you didn't know would be valuable until you needed it. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. I don't know if a researcher would come up with it. Like there's this biography of Nero written in the early 1900s, and there's a tiny little fact in there about his mistress and how that they found this plaque in Pisa in which she's begging the fertility goddess to bless her. And that kind of just jumped out at me because there was nothing about that about her in any of the other books, and I thought it was so easy to miss.
Right.
And I that made me think about her, and I thought, well, I want to know more about that, and it gave me kind of a key to her character, I think. So all these little things that I might find, it just might not strike anybody else particularly. You know,
now, you're on
Bell.
Book number, like, 8? Is it right? Or 7?
No, this is number 6.
Six,
if you don't
okay.
count children's, there's a children's book that I and a co-author did about our pet tortoise. It's an illustrated children's book.
All right.
Called Lucille Lost, and that was fun. We're thinking of doing. We're going to do a sequel to that too. We've just been working on that together, it'll be short.
Yes, not like your historical novels,
yeah.
But this is your sixth novel. The current the Roman is going to be your sixth novel.
No, it'll be my seventh.
You'll be your seventh. Okay.
Yeah,
now, do you reach a point in these novels? I think I know the answer to this, but I want to ask it anyway. Do you reach a point in the writing of it where you think, oh, this is just a complete mess I've created. I'm never going to make sense of this. Or do you always have a sense like, oh, this will work out fine?
I think probably the former. I mean, I think there comes a point where you think, first of all, you think you're never going to get finished with it. It's like you've been working on it and working on it and working
right.
on it. And second of all, there are phases you go through where when you first write it, you think it's just wonderful. And then
right.
you reread it, and it seems awful.
Right.
And it seems like the worst, terrible, awful thing, and nobody could ever possibly like it.
Right.
But by that point, you're all committed, and they're waiting for it, so you have to send it in.
Right.
And, you know, I'm always surprised that somebody likes it. You know, because by that point, I'm thinking it's terrible.
Right, so you've written the thing, and you've rewritten, and you've researched, and you finally finish it,
mm-hmm.
and then you do your final read before you send it off to your editor, and you go, what have I done? What a
bore. Exactly. Think, what have I done?
It.
It's terrible.
Yes.
In fact, when my copy-edited manuscript of the Henry VIII came back to me, I was living in Germany at the time, and it was long before electronics and all that stuff.
Right.
And I read it, I thought it was so horrible. I wanted to throw it in a dumpster and pretend that it got lost coming overseas. At that point, there was only one copy.
I can burn the evidence.
And I thought, if it disappears, you know, I can do this. But of course, I didn't. But the thought went through my mind because I was sure it was terrible.
Ah, I so love to hear this. You know, and I think there's a lot of our listeners out there who, and I, you know, it's funny, Margaret. I actually was going to guess that it was the latter, that you actually that there's something so pragmatic about you. I thought maybe you didn't do this, but it's good to hear you do it too, because I think pretty much. Every single writer goes through. It's an amazing thing. Now, one of my favorite stories is Judy Blume, who's published over 100 books. And when I interviewed Louis Sachar, he mentioned to her, have you ever gone through that experience of finishing a book and wondering if it's any good? And she said, every single one. 100 books.
Oh.
So you see, you're in good
wow.
company. Well, Margaret, a little bird in my ear just told me our time is nearly up. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very, very much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you again.
Well, I did too. So everybody, get out there. If you haven't read Elizabeth, get it. It's in paperback now. And look for you. Do you have a title for your next one? You probably don't.
Oh, no, I don't. But,
all right. Well,
hey,
it's going to be about Rome. It'll be awesome.
Welcome reader suggestions.
Okay. Oh, boy, now you've got it. Thanks again, Margaret.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, bye.
Bye. And thank you all for listening. Been another great show. Don't miss us next week. I'm going to have Sir Ken Robinson on. We'll be talking about education. We'll be talking about living your life with passion and just the way you want to. In the meantime, I encourage you to write the book you most want to write and to lead the life you most want to lead. Do that. Really can't go wrong. Thanks again.